Hey guys, real quick before we jump into this next episode, I want to discuss something with you. I made a decision a couple of years ago not to bombard this podcast with tons of ads or just bombard you with sponsorship. Nothing would drive me more crazy when listening to other podcasts when the first 5 minutes were nothing but ads. So I worked hard not to do that to you. I try to keep the ads to a minimum and keep the podcast as streamlined as possible. So do me a favor. Go check out Phoenix Shooting Bags. Buy yourself a bag. Up your shooting game. You're going to thank me. And if you're not a rifle hunter, go buy yourself a glassing pad. Your butt is going to thank me after spending hours behind the glass. They're awesome. If you use promo code John Stallone, all one word, you'll save 20%. And lastly, please, I know you heard me say it, iTunes, Podbean, go leave us a review. I need the feedback. The ratings help me reach more people, and it helps me keep this free. So do me a favor, check out Phoenix Shooting Bags, and go leave us a review. Thank you. Let's roll into this next episode. Hey guys, this is a bonus episode. I got the opportunity to sit down with Cody Rich of the Rich Outdoors and do a little podcast on elk hunting. And we talk about a bunch of different stuff. It's a good podcast, but go check out Cody's. If you don't already listen to it, go check out Cody's podcast. It's a good podcast. It's the Rich Outdoors. Thanks.
All righty, John. Welcome to the podcast, man. We've been talking about doing this one for a long time, but just haven't made it happen.
Couple of years.
I know. Well, it's always like, well, we always inevitably try to do it right before season. And then I don't know about you, but my like right before season is so chaotic and I'll book a lot of shows. And then it's just like, you know, when you book a lot of shows, a lot of podcasts, and then they start to like bunch together and then like people's time's off and like, you know, you're trying to get stuff ready for season and just chaos. And generally my schedule starts to fall apart about now.
Well, my schedule's chaotic all year long. I honestly do get a lot more podcasts done when I'm gonna say spring. That's about the only time that I'm okay with podcasts. Like from I want to say like right after javelina season ends here and we stop guiding. From like the end of that till May, I'm really in podcast mode. I could bang out like I could bang out 5 or 6 a week, no problem.
But
right after that, and everything goes out the freaking door. Because then I'm like, I'm like June, July, I'm back setting trail cameras. I'm doing this, I'm doing that, and then plus my other business is swimming pools. So that's my super super busy. I'm busy all year round with that, but that's where I'm the most hands on is when like June, July, right now, August. This is like the worst possible time in my other businesses, right? And which sucks is because hunting's starting now, you know?
Yeah.
Opening days today in Arizona. I didn't even go this morning. And I got a tag in Nevada that I went for a couple days, came home, and I've been so busy with work that I haven't been able to get back up there. I hope to get back up there on Sunday is my plan, but we'll see.
I know how that goes. Too much going on. So John Stallone's got another fellow podcaster. You've been doing it longer than pretty much anyone. I mean, you were doing podcasts before they were called podcasts, right?
Yeah.
Yep. Was it like back like early? What made you get into the whole? I can't even call it podcasting, but like I guess it was podcasts before podcasts.
They were called podcasts because originally the podcast you had to. And the reason why it's called a podcast, you had to download it to your iPod.
Mm-hmm.
Listen to it.
That's right. I remember when I first found out about podcasts, it was like 2007 or 8. Mm-hmm. And someone was like, hey, you should check out this podcast. So I was like, I don't know what that is. But yeah, I started listening to podcasts pretty regularly. 2007, 2008. I just remember being like, man, there's so much information. Because I was like big into entrepreneurship at that time. That's when I first started getting entrepreneurship and it like opened my eyes to this world that like people could deep dive into subjects that I had never heard about, like It was right. That opened my eyes big time.
It was crazy because it's such a consumable format, and you could do it when and where you want.
Totally.
You don't have to have internet connection. I mean, you have to have it to download it originally, but it's portable. You know, take it with you, and hell, I mean, you could. I seem to listen to most of mine when I'm driving around, working, or I'm at the gym. You know, when I'm doing something like doesn't really require a pump up. You know.
Yeah. Like
I don't need the jams to get me going.
Just grinding out miles on the treadmill.
Something like that, yeah. Just where I'm like on the elliptical and it's mindless or something like that, you know, just fade off. But
yeah, are you like me, like just basically consume most of your content through audio? Like I watch very, very few videos. And I can't remember the last time I actually read a book, even though I listen to an audiobook every single week. But like that's just me. I'm way too ADD like to watch TV or to read or like any of that stuff. So like audio is like the perfect, and I really found out that like I did not do well in school, and so when I found out audiobooks, it was like right after podcasting, and I used to drive a boatload, but it was like the perfect amount of like slowing my brain down because I was like doing this other thing. And then like my brain could process the information that was getting put in. But otherwise, like my brain just bounces off the wall and I don't retain anything. So audio has like been like the number one format for me for at least like information retention.
I do very well with audio. A little story back when I was in college. My chemistry teacher, I fell asleep in his class and he was rattling off about this. I don't know what the fuck it was. Actually, wasn't. Yeah, it was chemistry. He was rattling off about something and I fell asleep and he came and he smacked the bottom of my desk and he's like, "Mr. Stallone, would you care to elaborate on, you know, whatever the fuck it was?" I don't even remember what it was. And I literally like spat it back at him verbatim what he just said. And when I was like, it went into my brain while I was sleeping, you know. And he never bothered me from that point on after that. Like he let me fall asleep in his class. Like, I was passing tests and shit. But yeah, so I do very well with audio. I do listen to a lot of audiobooks as well.
Do you have a favorite audiobook, just out of curiosity?
You know, I do have a series that I listen to like every single one, and it's kind of like one of those, it's kind of like a sci-fi type deal. It's called Dies the Fire is the original.
Dies the Fire. I'm going to write this down.
It's so basically what happens is at some point, and I think it takes place in the 90s, but all technology goes away. It's like a magical event, okay? And so firearms don't work, no electricity. Basically takes you back to the Middle Ages. Whatever tech worked in the Middle Ages, that's what's there. And so like the whole world, this happens to the whole world. And you see all these different groups of people like forming clans and da-da-da. It's like a survival thing. I mean, in the first book, I mean, they're talking about hunting like constantly, you know, that's kind of what sparked my, continually sparked my interest about it. But, you know, they're all like bowyers and everything, everybody's archers and, you know, learning how to shoot this and that and sword work. And all. It's like, you know, I'm not like a Dungeons and Dragons kind of guy or any of that, but it's a really, really good series. Like, there's some things in there. You're like, as a hunter, you're like, fuck, that would never happen. You know, that's,
totally.
But it's a really cool series. But as far as like, I listen to like a lot of self-help crap. I just listened to a book called The Five Love Languages.
I'm gonna just like call myself out. Like I've definitely read that book, by the way.
Okay. And I picked it up because, I picked it up because I picked up the wrong one. I was picking it up because...
That's what they all say, dude. It's cool.
No. I was trying to get the one that was for kids.
Okay.
My middle daughter is... she's a handful. Let's just put it that way. And so I was looking for something, and somebody had recommended that book to me. And I downloaded the wrong one, and it was the one for, you know, your
just
spouse's
the regular podcast. One.
But yeah. I'm glad I did, because that one was freaking awesome. And I realized a lot of things about where I might have some issues in my marriage that I'd like to improve on.
Yeah.
They're freaking awesome, dude. And you look, and it made me think about like relationships that I had with other people and other family members. And I looked at a bunch of that. I mean, it makes you look at things a lot differently, which is, and it's an easy book to listen to.
Super totally. Easy. And this, so that book, we're going to spin this into hunting. That book is a great recommendation for guys and gals, whatever it may be, when it comes to those who struggle with like that whole spouse situation and hunting and like I'm time away and all these things like that. Like that's actually a really, really good book. 'Cause like when you understand what your partner wants out of a situation, like it makes it easier for you to like meet those. And then the whole like, hey, I'm leaving for the month of September gets a lot easier.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And luckily for me, I was already doing a lot of the stuff in that book. Yeah. Like I'm one of those guys that I speak all the love languages to my wife, so she never really feels whatever. But now that I know what to specifically target, I could be a lot more strategic.
Dude, I had no idea this is where this podcast was going, but so epic.
It's so funny, but I like that book. I would have recommend any married couple definitely. You know, you the guy definitely read it, and then make your wife read it.
Yeah, it's good.
A lot better, and your hunting will get better too, because you'll be able to hunt more.
Oh, I guarantee, like your average days of hunting will go up if you read this book and actually act upon this book. Like most books, like yeah, you can read it, but like, oh, that's some great stuff. But if you don't act on it, it doesn't do any good. You're talking about nonfiction books, like so. I still am 99.9% nonfiction, but every once in a while, like sometimes I just read so much nonfiction that you get into a rut. And so you were talking about like some of those fiction books, and I actually wrote that down because I don't know, for some reason, like I like to do a fiction book from time to time, like maybe one or two a year. And I was thinking about that because like during scout season, it seems like I am putting a ton of miles in my pickup, and it helps time go by just like listen to a story like that. Whereas nonfiction can, you know, you just kind of get burnt out on it for too many hours. But one of my favorites is anything by Neil Gaiman is amazing. But one of my favorite books is a Neil Gaiman book called The Graveyard. And it's about this kid that like grows up in the graveyard, and it's totally, I mean, it's kind of out there, but awesome book. Like it sucks you in. So anybody that's got like, I don't know, you know, 20-hour drive to hunting camp this year, that's another great one. It's like, just sucks you in. It's a great story. And all of his stuff is really, really good.
I got to check that out. Yeah. I'm listening to that kid's one right now. As soon as I'm done with that, I'm going to find myself a book that's going to take me, you know, out of my, I don't want to think. I want to listen to a, you know, take me to a different place. So a good
totally. Dude, get the Graveyard book. It's so good. I have listened to it probably three different times. That's like, I was just like, oh, I'll listen to that book again if I need a good story time, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, you're out of Arizona, right?
Correct.
So we're going to talk, well, I did want to dive into like bow hunting coyotes or calling coyotes bow hunting archery. That's pretty sure. Epic. But I also, we're going to talk a little bit about calling tactics, things like that. You and I come from different parts of the world, so it'd be fun just kind of, I don't know, BS and compare notes and things like that. So a little bit about, I mean, you obviously Arizona, don't get to elk hunt all the time. You doing any elk hunting this year?
I have one client here, and I may help two of my guides that work for me, drew tag this year, and I might get out with them, but I'm going to Oregon.
What?
I hunt with the guys from Angry Spike.
Okay.
I'll be out there at the tail end of the hunt for sure.
That's right. You went with Corey last year, didn't you?
Yeah.
So yeah. What's your thought on the whole Roosevelt hunting thing?
Well, that was my second time going. The first time I hunted in Washington. And, you know, I had some opportunities. I actually could have shot a bull the first day on my hunt in Washington, but I wasn't educated on Rosie's. Like, I looked at this bull and I'm like, it's a fucking raghorn. Excuse my French. But, you know, I didn't know, like, I didn't know that.
AKA a giant Roosevelt.
You know, it wasn't, no, but it wasn't a giant Roosevelt. I know. It was maybe, he was maybe, I mean, I've looked at mule deer bigger than that, but you know, maybe 200 inches, you know?
Yeah.
And I had him at 30 yards. I drew back on him, shoot him in my head, and I let him go, you know? I just had looked and saw what Pope and Young was, you know? That was my only, but I didn't know what to expect. Could have shot a couple cows on that trip. Got on a nice 5x5 the very last evening, and I ran out of cover, and I couldn't call him because I was in a clear cut. So if I would have called, he would have known, like, you know, would have known that there was something up.
Yeah.
And I got to about 65 yards on him, though. And in most cases, I would have taken the shot because I'm kind of a gunslinger. But yeah, I killed a bull here at 83 yards. 2016. Yeah.
Well, I mean, Roosevelt's the size of a barn, so.
Yeah, passed through. But anyway, so I didn't get one on that trip, and then the last year I actually shot one with Corey, but I was shooting a super heavy arrow setup, and I still don't know today what I did exactly, but I feel like I picked the wrong pin, which is not me. Like, I never do that. Like, you know, I'm so, because of the bow hunting coyote thing, I'm so automatic with acquiring target and shooting. But I hit him really low. And I feel like if I was shooting my normal setup, because of the arrow speed difference, the arrow speed difference was substantial, you know, like 50 feet per second, some kind of shit, you know?
Yeah.
But I hit him low and he bled like an SOB. So I must've caught him like just below the heart, you know, not clipped anything important on the sternum, is what I think happened. And, we trailed him for like a mile, and then all of a sudden the blood went from lots of blood to nothing. We were scratching our heads. We're like, what the freak? And then really I had a couple other opportunities, but we had really bad weather that whole week. It was literally coming down if it wasn't raining, it was pouring. And if it wasn't, you know, if it wasn't windy, it was gusting, you know, it was bad. It was fog the whole time. It was not a good, elk hunting week for, as far as weather was concerned anyway. Dude,
that's Oregon Roosevelt right there. Like, that's what I miss about it. Rain gear for 30 days of season.
Yeah. Nope.
So this year going back out, like, you, what's your, any game plan changes, or what's your thought going into the season? You're still holding out for Pope and Young?
No, I think Brown is down now. I did that to myself with blacktail. So far now, the two animals that I've hunted more than once, or the only two animals that I've hunted more than once and haven't killed, are rosies and blacktails. And blacktail, I went 5 years. Yeah, 5 years. 5 years I spent. And I mean, I say 5 years, but I calculated how many days that was. It was like 36 days I hunted blacktail, which is, I mean, that's a lot, but it's not.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I didn't spend like five seasons hunting blacktail and not get one. And I've been doing it in California.
Yeah.
I went once in, sorry, 1 year was in Washington. So 4 years in California, 1 year in Washington. And Washington, I was tree stand hunting. Again, I could have shot a good buck, but I didn't. I've had tons of great encounters, and I could have made it happen several times, but it, like, something always just fell apart at the right. So those are my white, that's my white whale, is the blacktail. And I don't want rosies to become that also.
Yeah, no, man, like, I don't know. I feel like any Roosevelt with a bow, any bull, is really good. I mean, a cow's good too, but like, if you want to go up there, I think if you're hunting out of state, it's a bull is doable, you know, raghorn. And then I always say, like, get the monkey off your back, because, like, I feel like a lot of people, and this could be said for a lot of hunts, you go into a hunt like that, and those really, really challenging hunts, it's like, you feel like, it may never happen, and you just don't have that confidence. And then it becomes that monkey on your back where it never does happen. And like, you take it off and you just whack one. It's like, okay, let's start looking for a Pope and Young.
Yep, exactly. Now it's like, now every time I go back to California, I got this extra added weight on my shoulder because I know social media is watching too. I've been so open about it, you know. Yeah. Now it's like I got guys that are rooting for me and guys that are rooting against me. So it's like, oh, freak, I gotta do something now. And I think I force things. Like when I start getting into that mindset, I start forcing things.
Dude, it's crazy how it's such a mind game. Like antelope with a bow for me was one of those, like, where every time I went on a archery antelope hunt, like I had this thing in the back of my head that I was going to miss because I had missed more antelope than anything. And it was like, ah, don't miss, you know, like, and like inevitably I think that like just that subconscious in the back of your head, you know, grinding at you, telling you you're going to miss, and it happens. And it's still like, man, the mental games can just fuck you.
Oh, without a doubt. I think mental game is more important than your physical game.
So for dudes that like going into a hunt, and this is a good example, you're going into an elk hunt this year, deer hunt, whatever it may be, and you've struck out the last couple of years, maybe it was just 1 year, like whatever it is, you have this monkey on your back, in the back of your head, your confidence is super low. How does one overcome that?
Well, for me, one of the things I do is here's a good analogy, a good story. Okay. So my cousin, when I was getting him into archery, he would, you know, shoot a great group and then, you know, go back, you know, sorry, he'd shoot great one day and then he'd go back and the next day he'd go to shoot and he couldn't hit the side of a barn. I would grab his bow and be like, oh, here, give me that. Let me fix that for you. And I'd, you know, pretend like I was screwing around with the sight, you know, and making adjustments or whatever. And I said, okay, now shoot it. And I want you to follow through and hold that pin on the sight. And then he would shoot, you know, a golf ball size group at 50 yards, you know?
Yeah.
Oh man. Yeah. You fixed it. It's perfect. So I've kind of, you know, just how much the mental game is, you got to have something to blame.
Yeah.
He needed to blame the sight was off in his head. So me, if I didn't have success, I look at what I did and I try to do it differently or improve the things that I did. And I try to control the things that I can control, because obviously, you know, in hunting, you can't control everything, but, and that's always worked for me. Like if I have something to blame, you know, it's easier for me to go fix that one thing.
Yeah.
And go back and look at it fresh and say, okay, now I can do it, you know, instead of being like, oh, you just, you know, sucked that year or whatever, you know.
I get another example that brought to mind. So a few years ago, actually it was a long time ago, probably the last time I hunted Idaho, I went in and I was like, okay, I don't remember if I had 8 days or whatever it was. So I think I had 8 days and I told myself I had four. I was like, you have 4 days. You got to get it done. Like, make it happen quick. And I think that stemmed from me wanting to go to another tag. And so like, I just put it in my head that it was 4 days. And when it didn't happen at 4 days, it was a good reset for me. So I could basically say, okay, this is a new hunt. And it's like, instead of like, oh, I just failed, or I am failing, I'm halfway through this hunt and I haven't got it done, I'm failing, it was like this clean sheet. And so this year I'm kind of doing the same thing with Montana. I would love to be done with, so I got to be back for backcountry fuel box stuff on the 18th. So I basically have from the 7th to the 17th, and I'm telling myself or putting in my head, like, you have 10 days. And I'd love to be done, cause there's another hunt I want to go do. Right. After box on the 20th. So ideally it would like happen. Like I get my tag punched somewhere between the 7th and the 17th, which is plenty of time to do a hunt. Right. So I'm going to set that in my head and like, that's my go time. But if it doesn't happen, then I basically have I have another hunt. I could go back out and hunt Montana bulls, after the 20th. So that's like a reset date for me. It's like, this is a different hunt. You're not failing. You're not like whatever. It's just like this reset. So like, set a number of days and be like, this is the hunt. And then when that's over, it's like, okay, now we're on this other hunt, you know, same place, but we learned so much. But it's like, instead of feeling like you're failing, it's like a reset button.
No, that's a good way to look at it. I mean, so I'm kind of doing that right now with Nevada. I went up there. I really only hunted 3 days because the first day and a half I was there was just scouting and the season wasn't open. I hunted 3 days and I was literally within 20 yards of my target buck three different times and I just couldn't make it happen. And I came home. We had to come home for something else, but this is the first time I'm going back on a out of state hunt. So I like that. I like that idea that you have. Like if you have the time, if you can do that, that's great. But I've never been able to. Like my seasons are all, you know, I look at my season as 7 days. I mean, I very, very, very rarely hunt more than 7 days in a row. Because I can't leave my family. I can't, and there's too much crap going on.
Yeah.
My wife is cool with me going for 7 days. And so it's like I've never gone 7 days out of state and not got something and then came home and then figured out how to go back there and do it again.
Yeah.
I feel like if I did that, it'd be game over for sure.
Yeah.
Because so California with the blacktail, every time I've never stayed there, the longest I've hunted there was six days. Every time I felt like if I had two more days, if I had three more days, this would be done. Because it took me that long to figure everything out, where I was getting close enough and, you know, to making it happen.
Are you familiar with like the 80-20 principle? It's like, was it Pareto's or whatever? Like 80% of his garden or 20% of his garden produce 80% of the plants, and you can break everything down to like 80% of this creates 20% of that. I feel like there's an 80-20 rule of a hunt. It takes 80% of the time to figure it out and 20% to kill it. And so even if like guys, and I know my situation is different because it, you know, if you get more time or whatever, but I think anybody, like if, say you had 7 days, if you put it in your head, you know, tell yourself this like placebo that you have five, then you're going to spend 80% of that time of those 5 days figuring it out. And that gives you more time to kill, if that makes any sense.
No, that makes perfect sense. I have heard I didn't know that that's what it was called, but I've heard a similar principle of that. And yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So,
yeah. I was looking it up. Make sure I'm right. Pareto's principle. I don't know. Like that's, I think that's one of the biggest things is like, I see a lot of people and I made this mistake a lot. It's like you go in feeling like you have too much time and then you start to get down. That's where that monkey jumps on your back and, you know, starts to get in your own head when you don't have much time left. And I mean, it's always hard to operate when you're like up against the wall and you feel like you're like, oh man, I only got two more days. It's crazy how your brain starts to work when you feel like it's not going to happen. Like when that light switch and you start justifying in your head, like why you weren't successful on a hunt, like, man, that's the worst. And I know when it happens, cause I'll be like, I'm just thinking about what I'm going to have to tell people, which is like so terrible. I don't know. Like, I don't know how you get away from that.
I know. And that's what this world's become though, man. We're always worried about whatever the frick everybody else wants. It's because our lives are out in front of everybody.
Yeah. And
you know, you're in the spotlight, you know, you have a following, you have the podcast and what you got on social media, that it's like, you know, you there's extra pressure. There's a, you know, and you know what's funny to me, and I was just thinking about this while you were when you were just ending with your last paragraph over there. Right. Your last that when I had the TV show, there was a lot of pressure on me to perform. But for some reason, so last year was the first full season. And I don't know if this just might be coincidental, but this is the first full season that I didn't have a cameraman with me and somebody follow me around and blah, blah, blah. But I went 15 years in a row filling 85% of my tags, and that's 7 to 10 tags a year. 85% of my tags I filled for 15 years. Last year I filled 2 tags, and I only had 8, but
wow. Do you think that's just because like you didn't have the pressure?
And I was thinking about that when you were just saying that. I was like, you know, it crossed my mind at one point. I'm like, maybe I just rise to the occasion, and that's why I was able to do it. Or it just might be coincidental, and I had a shitty year. But
I feel like when you don't have a camera guy, though, like you don't have that obligation to shoot stuff. Like I do feel like when there's a camera guy with you, like there's some obligation to like get it all on camera, right? Right. I probably wouldn't shoot that buck, but it's on camera. It's perfect. I'll do it. I
mean, the cameraman definitely. That's why my trophy room is a museum of the medium. I don't have a lot of giants or bulls. I mean, I actually my bulls are pretty good bulls. I have 3 bulls that are over 340. So,
damn.
But, I think that you start thinking brown is down is a lot quicker in your hunt.
Totally.
When you got to make a TV show. Yeah, for sure. Because, I mean, hell, there was a time, and now that this is switched because, you know, the industry keeps swaying back and forth, but there was a time that if you didn't have a kill shot, you didn't have a TV show. And we had contracts with some sponsors that were like, you needed to kill X amount of things a year on film, you know, to
no pressure it. At all.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. No, you know.
That doesn't change the yes. everything around your hunting. No, not at all. Oh, that's why I don't do film. Okay, let's get talk a little bit about calling. And we're going to start out by talking about calling coyotes, archery calling coyotes. And then I want to kind of talk about how that like translates into elk hunting. We'll talk some elk tactics, elk calling, and things like that. And maybe sure. things that you've picked up from coyotes. So let's start off with like calling coyotes, shooting with a bow. Where did that all start? And what are like, let's get into that whole thing. Just deep dive right in.
Okay. Well, I mean, it really spawned from the fact that, well, in Arizona and most places you can hunt coyotes all year round. But so it was one, something to do. But for me, it was the main focus was it was a tool for me to improve my archery hunting. You know, when you're predator hunting, you're still doing all the woodsmanship stuff. You're still checking wind. You're still looking for sign. You're still, you know, entering in. I mean, if you're doing it right anyway, you're entering and leaving without making a big impact. You know, you're not trying not to skyline. You're trying to use drainages to sneak in. You're paying attention to the terrain and so on and so forth. So, and then, of course, shooting at a live animal is going to be better practice than shooting at a target. With coyote hunting specifically, because it's like a drive-by shooting, you know, they come flying in. You have to be very quick with your target acquisition. You have to be really good at judging ranges, and acquiring the shot and taking a quick shot. So
most scenarios when they come up, like you're set up, you're calling, I'm assuming, are you using the e-caller or just hand calls?
E-caller. I've only killed with the bow. I mean, with the rifle, a different story, but with the bow, I've only killed one or two with a mouth call.
So are you setting the e-caller up behind you?
No, in front of me.
In front of you. So on most situations that the coyotes run in, I mean, like, I guess everyone's seen like guys hunting with shotguns, I assume it's similar, kind of like basically dogs coming in, you might get a 2-second stop, 3-second stop, and that's about it. Like, is that kind of how it's been working?
Yeah, yes and no. So, I mean, hunting with a shotgun, the setup, for me anyway, I think a shotgun's probably the best weapon, period, because you can snap shoot and you got 100-yard range if you got a gun that's set up right, you know? But with the bow, you got to shrink that range down to under 50 yards and preferably under 40. And most of the times I kill coyotes, they're at 20 yards, 20 to 30 yards. So what I do is, and this is common with all calling. So you kind of set the stage earlier on there, about how it translates to everything else. So one of the things that I learned years ago from calling coyotes, this setup, this tactic works excellent for elk, works great for turkey, and even deer. So I call in deer all the time. I'm not an inherently sneaky person, so I like to bring animals to me. excuse me. So, and if you listen to Chris Rowe, he kind of talks about it, you know, like a doorway principle. I don't remember exactly how he puts it, but he explains it really well. So the commonality with all calling is at some point that animal is going to get to a spot that he or she feels like they should see whatever's calling to them, whatever's making that sound. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's the hang up spot, basically. And in order for you to have great success in calling anything, you want to be able to make it so that when that animal gets to the hang up spot, it's already in your kill zone where you can make a shot.
100%. That's, I think, people's biggest problem with calling out.
Right, exactly. I mean, you hear it all the time. Oh, I called in this bull and he hung up at 80 yards.
Yeah.
You know, or, you know, coyote
he
hunt.
He wouldn't cross this 150-yard meadow.
Exactly. Well, why don't you think he will cross that hunt? Because he's not a stupid ass. He knows that he should be able to see.
Yeah.
You know, something's fishy. Something's not right here. I know that I should be able to see whatever it is that's calling me. Now, with coyote hunting specifically, you can get really creative if you're using like a jackrabbit in the stress call or something like that. It's easy to hide that size of an animal, you know.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
In a bush.
Yeah.
So that coyote has to come to that bush to look at that bush specifically to see that animal that's making the noise. Now you're talking about a bull, elk, or you're making cow sounds, let's say, you know, you got to hide a cow. So your bush has to be a lot bigger. Okay.
Yeah.
I break it down into, the hide, which is where the caller is, the person calling or your e-caller, the blind, which is where the shooter is. And I like to set the wind up, I always like to have the wind perpendicular to what, not necessarily exactly perpendicular, but I like perpendicular because to the shooter, because that usually brings an animal will circle and get on the, you know, direct line of the wind of that, where the sound's coming from, and come in. Now, if you got a buddy calling for you, you don't want to do that. We're talking specifically with an e-caller. You want to have perfectly perpendicular wind, because it'll bring that animal across you broadside. In the situation of like elk calling and stuff like that, I like quartering winds. I don't mind. I like the wind in my face too, but 9 times out of 10, you're going to get a, you know, either get a frontal shot or you're going to have somebody or have an elk try to come in from behind you. I definitely don't like wind in the face when I'm predator calling, because I don't want a lion to crawl up my backside or, you know, a coyote to come from directly behind. Because they'll do that, you know. So wind is a very, very important part. I mean, everybody knows wind's an important part of hunting, but the actual direction of the wind is very important when you're trying to make the setup. It's hard for me to paint a picture But I call it the room. Okay. Let me try to think of a good setup here. Well, I'll tell you a coyote setup. And then, so if I'm here in the desert, if I walk through the desert and I get to a group of trees, a line of trees, and then there's like a 20, 30 yard opening, and then there's another line of trees, and there's one big tree in the middle of this thing. Okay. If you could picture it like a 30 yard circle, mm-hmm. one tree in the middle, that's like golden. That's like the most perfect setup ever, because I could put the caller in that tree that's now 15 yards in front of me. I can get in the tree line behind me, conceal myself. And I call, a coyote's going to come into that 30 yard opening, and they might just hang up there and might not go to the tree, but they're already in the 30 yard opening. But 9 times out of 10, they're going to go straight to that tree because they want to see the rabbit that's calling to them.
And totally. No,
15, that, shot, you know?
No, totally. And I was just thinking, like, that's a good analogy for, like, say elk. I like where there's like a break in types of terrain or types of vegetation. So if we're talking about open timber. So if you have just nothing but open timber for as far as the eye can see, the elk's going to feel like they should see something there. But I like where, say, it's like in Western Oregon, there's a lot of reprod. And so it's like reprod or timber, or like there's like different ages of timber. And this will happen throughout. I mean, even in the wilderness, there's like where there's burns and then there's super thick reprod and there's kind of open timber. And so if you have this open timber, instead of trying to get into the open timber in the same capacity, if you could utilize, say, some just thick stuff, some reprod, whatever it may be, you can't see through it. But there's usually a line. You almost always find these like longer lines. So instead of being like, imagine a chunk of reprod that's in the middle of fairly open timber. And I'm using hand signals so no one on a podcast can see. I don't know why. Maybe I'm just using it for myself, so don't judge me. But so you have like a chunk of reprod in the middle of open timber. It's like the elk can look at that chunk, that little round spot, and say, okay, if there's something in there, it's going to come out pretty soon. So I'm just going to wait. So instead of like hiding in a bush in the open, that's not going to work. But if you have a line, they usually like to walk those lines. And so if you make it seem – make it easy for them to move along a line of openness, they'll almost always do that. It's like they hit that thick and then they don't want to go into the thick, so they'll just kind of work down the line trying to figure it out. And you see this with turkeys, you know, like you were talking about with coyotes, like they'll work those lines of the thick to thinner. It doesn't have to be open and thick, but it's like thick to thinner. Does that make any sense? Did I put it together a little bit?
Absolutely. You mentioned Oregon, and the thing I love about Oregon is that type of terrain, everything's a room, because it's so thick that you only have 10 yards of opening and then thick, 10 yards opening and thick, you know? So it's almost, and I know I'm going to get shit for this, but it's almost easier to call an elk there into bow range because of that. Now they're super called to, you know, it's over the counter tags and it's super high pressured. So, but if you took that same scenario and it was like a trophy unit that only had a handful of tags in, I bet you it'd be like the best freaking, it'd be like the best hunting ever because of that. But unfortunately,
yeah, because an elk has to get to bow range. Now whether you get a shot is another story altogether, because I'm sure you've been within bow range and like, man, never saw him, he was 20 yards from me. Yep, didn't see him. I have no idea.
No, for sure. Yeah, no, that poses a problem too. But that all goes into, so what I was just about to get into is, you always have to, when you're choosing your setup, you have to be on the other side of the call. Think about if you were the person running in to see what was going on, who was calling to you, what would you do? How would your route be? And think about it from the standpoint of the animal that you're hunting, from an elk. Okay, I'm coming in, I want to breed this cow, or I want to come fight this other bull. Why am I coming in? How am I going to come in? What senses am I going to use? You know, all right, I'm going to be looking, I'm going to be listening, I'm going to be smelling. So, you know, if you get on the other side of the call and you think about it from that aspect, and that's why bow hunting coyotes is a great tool, because you learn this stuff just continually doing it time after time after time, and you can apply it to your, you know, your elk hunting or your turkey hunting. I don't consider myself a good elk hunter, but I've had great success because of this. I'm not a good caller. I mean, I know how to make a lot of elk sounds, and I'm getting better over the years, but I'm not a, you know, go win a championship, you know, elk caller. But, you know, my setups are good. And I feel like a lot of people waste time trying to learn how to be a good caller, and they don't think about the setups. You could be a mediocre caller and be able to have tremendous success if you choose the right setup.
No, and this is like why I kind of want to bring up this whole coyote calling thing, because lately I've been talking a lot about at-bats, and I think it's really important for guys to just get at-bats. Like, if you want to be good hunter, you want to be, you know, proficient, you have to have at-bats. You have to swing and miss enough times to know what the pitch looks like. And this is like the coyote hunting. You just set up after set up after set up and learn. You can learn so much faster. And it's just, you know, it's like repetition, and you start to see the patterns. And I don't think there's, like you said, there's not a whole lot of difference. There's some variance differences, but for the most part, if you did 100 setups on coyotes and called in even 25, you're going to be 10 times the elk hunter than mm-hmm. if you had not done that.
Absolutely. Now, the big thing about, you know, the coyote thing versus the elk is if you're using an e-caller. So the setup is going to be, the principles are going to be the same, but the actual setup's a little different.
Yeah.
So, let's just say you're calling for yourself. One of my favorite setups for elk hunting and deer hunting is putting a rise between me and the animal. And, you know, of course you have to have that, you know, that has to be there. It's not like you can create that. But if you can, like say you glass up a bull or something, okay, and he's on the other side of this ridge, but it's like I don't even want to call it a ridge. He's on the other side of this rise, and you know you can easily get to the opposite side of the rise from him. If you can do that, and you know the situation's right, the wind is right, you got the wind, you know, in your favor. Again, doesn't necessarily have to be in your face. And you call to that elk that's on the other side of that rise, he's going to come up over the top, at least get to the very top to look down, or get to a spot where he thinks he should be able to see either the bull that's challenging him or the cow that's calling to him. And those are killer. I mean, one of the cool things about elk is you're going to see their tips of their antlers coming, and you're going to know exactly where he's going to come over. Same thing with deer. Now, coyotes, that situation, they're going to be in your lap by the time you figure they're coming over.
Yeah, they don't have as loud of a locate, so you can't hear them coming.
No, exactly.
No, that's great advice. Like, dude, I think in all aspects, when it comes to setup, is like curiosity kills the cat, and it also kills the elk. And you have to leave that curiosity. And this goes into even like, and this is where coyote and elk have a little bit of difference, but just not calling till, you know, all calling the elk all the way in. Like with the coyote and most predators, like you're calling that animal all the way to you, because if you stop, he's going to stop. But with an elk, it's like, I watch so many guys try to call, but it's like, let curiosity kill the cat. And whether that's a rise, whether that's like some thick area that he's kind of working through, or just him not knowing exactly where you are because you just shut up. And, you know, those are things like that absolutely kill elk. He's got to figure it out.
No, that's great. That's great point and great advice. You know, one of the things about that too is like, if you're calling and you can see the elk coming in, and you keep on calling them, you really run the risk of them pinpointing you exactly where the call's coming and actually picking you off.
Yeah.
Or hanging up to say, okay, well, I hear that coming from right there. I was coming in and I didn't know where it was exactly. I knew the general direction, but I didn't know it was right there at that, you know, that alder patch or whatever. And now I know it's coming from there. I'm going to sit here and look and see, wait to see what it is that's calling me.
You know what's funny about that, though, is like I was thinking about you hunting Rosies this year, and I do think Rosies take a little bit more. Like I think they get, and it's mainly because you got to be so damn close to get a shot. But a lot of times, man, it's like you got to just keep pushing their buttons, pushing their buttons, pushing their buttons. Because I've had Roosevelts just walk away because I was trying to like curiosity, not to contradict the statement I just made, but I was thinking about how Roosevelts, you know, can be 40 yards from you, and they're trying to figure it out. And a lot of that's like they're trying to let you come to them. They're trying to, you know, see you or see size up the situation, or maybe they're in a spot they like. And so, you know, they're trying to get you to go over to them. And if you won't do it, then they might give up. But that's, I guess, where Roosevelts may differ from, you know, say Rockies. And every terrain's different. This is the thing, you know, a lot of guys will talk about elk hunting and this tactic, that tactic. And I mean, as you know, like Arizona is different than Oregon. Like it just is. I mean, the type of terrain is so different between what you're hunting in Arizona and the coast range of Oregon. It's like night and day. So of course the elk are going to act a little different.
Yeah, no, but I mean, so much of that has to do with what we were just talking about earlier, is that it's so thick in Oregon that, and the vegetation, it covers up everything. Mm-hmm. That you can get away with just continually calling, continually calling. They're right there in your lap, you know, because the hang up is only 10 yards away.
Yeah. I mean, the confirmation is 10 yards. Like, for him to know that there's no elk there, he's got to basically smell you. Or, I mean, because you could be 10 yards and in certain spots and he can't see you. So, like, there's no way at 40 yards he can know that there's no elk there. Like, rarely have I had a Roosevelt bust out because he waited and then all of a sudden he's like, something's not right. There's no elk there. And then took off and started barking at me. Like, that's usually for a different reason. But like you said, it's so friggin' thick that you can get away with a lot more. You can bugle and bugle, and for all he knows, there's a whole herd of elk there.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And I'm definitely not a Rosie expert, but I did notice in the two seasons that I hunted, or two times that I went hunting there, is that, and I also picked this up from the guys telling me, you know, like solidifying this in my head, is that you almost have to be more aggressive with them because again, the terrain's so thick, like they're not as concerned with a bull that is bugling 200 yards away. You know, they're like, you know, that guy's 200 yards away. It's going to take him 4 hours to get here for salmon berries, you know?
Yeah.
But so when you have to kind of get right on top of them, you have to really push their buttons and be like, yo, I'm here to mess with you, buddy, and take your girls, you know, for them.
I think that's applicable. Like, even if, you know, guys are like, well, I'm not hunting Arizona, or I'm not hunting Oregon either. Even if you're in Montana or Wyoming or Utah, Colorado, it doesn't matter. Scaling your calling to how thick the terrain is an important skill. Like, if you are in super dark timber, you can get away with more. If you are in very, very open country, you can't get away with as much. And so just scaling that back and forth. You know, Idaho is a great example. There's places in Idaho where guys are like, oh, you can't call, it's too open, you know. But if you get in a really thick patch or a thick coulee or a thick whatever, you can get away with it because they can't see that. They can't see whether there's elk there or not.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. Any advice for everybody kind of getting ready for archery season, last minute, like get out of your own head type advice?
Get out of your own head. Yeah. I'm a freaking head case, so no. But I know kind of what I touched on it a little bit earlier is that I really try to control all the things that I can control, because I know that there's so many variables that you can't control. So I spend a lot of time and rely a lot and put a lot of pressure on my preseason prep. So I do like when I, matter of fact, I just did a podcast about it. I think it came out today, about shooting. Like I put myself in a lot of lifelike situations and I try to make myself as automatic as possible so that I'm, don't have to rely on my, you know, my brain. I don't have to rely on thinking about it, I should say, you know, and try to make it as muscle memory as possible. Like I shoot my bow in every possible position that I think I would be faced with in the field while hunting that animal. And I always, shoot at like 3D targets and stuff like that in, you know, in a lifelike situation where I'm shooting uphill or downhill, through brush, quartering to facing you, all those things. Like I don't just stand in my backyard and shoot, you know, 50 arrows at 30 yards at a block target, you know, in a perfect archer's tee, because those are the things that like, you know, it's kind of like that, maybe not the best analogy, but it's like that analogy that, or that saying that it was the grain of sand in the guy's boot and not the mountain that took him down.
Yeah.
It's all these like little things that throw you off your game when you're out there that don't match your preparation that are usually become the demise of the hunt, you know?
No, totally. That's so accurate. Is there anything that you can think of? And I was trying to think of an example to give you, but is there anything like that used to ruffle your feathers on a hunt, you know, in the early days that now you do a better job just blowing it off? Like, you know, I think I could say that one example would be, you know, pressure. I remember just getting so mad, so frustrated when I ran into people and things like that. Not that I don't anymore, but I don't know that it ruffles my feathers in the sense that like what you're talking about, it's not the grain of sand or it's not the mountain, it's the grain of sand. And it's like all these little things that add up. And the more you can control those and try to not let things get in your head, the better. And I think I've gotten better over the years at just not letting those things get in my head, like people.
Yeah.
If I'm running into people, it's like, okay, what am I not seeing? How do I get away from these people? And I'm not saying it never gets in my head, but like those are the type of things I remember getting so pissed off about way back when. But try to let them go now. I'm not saying I'm perfect at it. Is there anything like that you can think of that used to get in your head that you've kind of let go?
Well, yeah. I think one of the things that, and it still gets me a little bit, is that if I don't get to a place on time.
Oh, that's the worst. That one still gets me.
Yeah, that drives me insane. Pressure doesn't really bother me because when I started hunting, in New York, and it's like, you know, World War III. But, you know, you go rifle season or whatever in upstate New York, and it's the Orange Army, you know. And so I got used to pressure and learning how to use pressure to my advantage. Yep. But yeah, it still irks me when I'm like here, when I'm driving, you know, I got up an hour and a half early or whatever, and I drive to a spot and then I hike in and I get to a freaking point that I wanted to glass from and there's a guy there and I'm like, fuck my life. You know, this is like, yeah, that kind of, but it goes back to the same thing. Like I want to be at a certain place at a certain time. And if I don't get there on that time, like I always feel like I'm racing light, you know, either light coming up or it's going to get too dark on me, you know, and like that shit gets to me a little.
I would say that gets to me too, but I think it stems from like just operating in this world where your day is so structured and you're like, okay, by 2, I need to have this done. I need that. Okay. I need to be done by 5 so I can get to here. And it's hard to turn that off when you go in the woods. And I just noticed this the other day when I was scouting. I was like, you know, nothing's here. I should jam out because I get, you know, 20 minutes of glassing at this last light, whatever. And like, you have to almost like delete all of your everyday life routines and time hacks and things like that and go on a different time. I never really thought about that, but you are 100% right. Like, I am pretty guilty of that just because my day is always so structured and I'm always on time hacks and I hate being late. But I've killed some of the biggest stuff in my life when I was an hour late to a spot and, you know, or whatever it may be. I remember as a kid, I must've been 16 because I had a driver's license. I think I had a good driver's license. I remember waking up and I was going to go hunting that morning. I must've overslept and it snowed that day. And I was so pissed. Like, I almost didn't go. I was just like, I missed daylight. It's a perfect day. It snowed. And I got up there pretty late and ended up shooting still one of the best blacktails ever shot to this day at like 10:30 in the morning. And yeah. I think it's easy to get wrapped around the axle about time. I think that's 100% true.
Yeah. I've probably 5 or 6 other stories that are very much like that one. And I try to think about those every time. Like, I start catching myself. Like, I know one of the things, like when I'm driving in, you know, I hunt out of motels a lot or a big truck camp. So I'm always like, you know, traveling in the morning or another. And, you know, so I'm driving in and if the sun is coming up, oh my God, my skin starts freaking crawling. Like, I want to be where I want to be while it's still dark out, you know? And when it doesn't work out that way, like especially freaking coyote hunting, like I want to have my truck parked and I want to start walking just, you know, to my first stand where I'm going to make a stand. I want to be like barely where I could barely be able to see. Cause as soon as the day breaks, I want to be the first thing that those coyotes hear, you know? And I had that same thing with deer, with the elk, I just want to be there at first legal light, you know?
I think this is definitely true when it comes to like deer hunting and, you know, you feel like you're late. So you're like hurrying, but how many times have you bumped a big buck on your way to somewhere? Because in your head, you had it set that you were going to be at this point and you weren't there. So you're like, you're double timing, but you're not paying attention if you're double timing. So then you're bumping stuff. And like that, I mean, dude, that's really good advice. I haven't thought about that.
Yeah. No, that's smart. I think mine stems from, you know, the years of whitetail hunting out of a tree stand, you know, like I always wanted to be in the tree stand an hour before light, you know, really there in the dark and be set up and quiet and let everything settle around me. You know, and it's also I think in our generation, we still think about the early bird gets the worm, you know, and not to offend the millennials. Sorry guys, but I was just talking to Shane, who's my hunting partner, but he also works for me. He's one of my guides. And he went out this morning and, you know, he got to the glassing spot. It was already after light. Like, he was calling me and he was just getting there. Like, I'm like, that was to me, like, he was telling me that story. And my freaking skin started crawling. It's like, I had a couple bucks cross me in the road as I was driving in. I'm like, well, if you were on a damn freaking top of a hill in the dark, that's what I told him. You would have seen them there, you know? You know, through the glass, and you would have been stalking them. He actually ended up stalking those bucks anyway, but felt
bad on him. Oh, that's so true. Well, any last advice for everyone headed out?
Just trust in your preparation. You know, keep a positive attitude, man. We touched on it a couple times in this. The mental game is the biggest thing. You got to believe that you could do it. You got to see it happen in your head. If you can picture it happening in your head, you have a better chance of making it happen. You can't go out there with a self-defeating attitude, like, oh, I'm going to go on this stalk and it's not going to work out for me, or this bull's going to come in and he's going to bust me or whatever. You have to believe and have to see it happening in your head. And I guarantee you, you'll be a lot more successful.
Oh, that's huge advice. Huge, huge, huge. Thank you, man. Thanks for jumping on. Finally made it happen. It went by quick. I just looked down. I was like, man, I can't believe it was an hour. Where can guys check out your podcast, everything you're up to, and follow along?
My blog is johnstallone.me, and pretty much from that you can find everything. But the podcast is interviews with the hunting masters. And that's pretty much on anything you can consume podcast, you know, from
wherever you found this, it's there too.
Yep, exactly. Exactly.
Well, good luck this year, man. Good luck in Nevada. Hopefully you get it done on round two. And good luck in Oregon. I'll be watching because I'm curious how you do there, how the Roosevelt hunt goes. Yeah. But yeah, I guess overall, just good luck this season, man.
Well, I got a leg up, so I got some good guys that are.
Yeah, you got a pretty good crew at Roosevelt Hunters.
The learning curve for me, but
for sure. Alrighty, buddy.
Down, buddy.
Thanks, man.
All right, take it easy.